Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. This is scan number 2525. Tonight we have a wonderful guest. His name is Mike Tikkanen, and he's from Hopkins, Minnesota. He's a returning NASCA family member and is founder and president of CARA Kids. That's Kids at Risk. Okay, so that's CARA. It's K-A-R-A. And he's going to tell us all about the program. And since the last time he was on, I think I probably interviewed him. We were just speaking about that. Since that last time that he came on, the program has changed a little bit, expanded a little bit. He has things to tell us about, and that's wonderful. We have a nice little crew here for the panel. This is very good. We have Lori from Calgary, and we have Mike, of course, and Bill from Florida, and Darlene from Tennessee. And Darlene is one of our ambassadors, and so is Lori. So that's very good. I'm just going to read the mission statement. We do this, and then after that, we'll get started with our show. And what we have, everyone here, as you know, and those who don't know, is a panel. And you can call in. The telephone number here is 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. And you can be a part of the panel. There are a few more spots. And also, too, you can ask questions. And I can, you know, ask those questions or answer them, I should say. Okay, first of all, we have a single purpose at NASCA, and that is to address issues related to child abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent and physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so two different ways. One is by educating the public, especially as related to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, and presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem. We know that this is true. Number two, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. And there is recovery, okay, if you get help. And as far as prevention is concerned, I'm very much for that and talk a lot about that. Okay, so Mike, we're so happy to have you on the show. And I love hearing about the progress that you're making. I read your bio. And I'm just happy you're here. Why don't you tell the public, okay? Just tell people exactly what you do and so forth. Go ahead.
Yeah, 20 years ago or so, we started an organization called Kids at Risk Action. And the mission is to support the people, programs, and policies that make life better for at-risk children, abused and neglected children. Now, I got into it as a guardian ad litem volunteer for the county, and it's stunning what you learn when that happens. I had about 50 children in my caseloads, and I removed actually all of them from toxic homes. And I have the belief that, at least where I live, the kids don't get into child protection unless things are so bad they have to be. They have to be. I mean, and the good news is now I think there are more services than when I started. and the desire to heal families is stronger, and the idea of relative placement is a little bit happier than it used to be. But our organization has had hundreds of volunteers over the years, and largely we are similar in our mission to educate and help people understand the depth and scope of the problems of child abuse and domestic violence that leads to child abuse, and the general nature of generational child abuse, where it really is hard for a family that has been abused to have, you know, the children go on to lead functional lives without some help from the community. So it's very important that the rest of the community understands why we have crisis nurseries and why we have support systems for troubled families. Today I'm going to start by talking about programs that we have that we think will make a big difference in the years to come. And the first one has to do with the changing nature of medicine and health care for mental health. And that has to do with how hard it's been for our communities to provide mental health historically. And now the good news is we're recognizing what PTSD does to soldiers, and it's starting to be aware of how that kind of trauma in a family for a child is even more impactful, because those children did not have a before that they could remember to compare to find normalcy, to be able to lead a functional life. And so the problems that have faced people with mental health issues in the country as a whole have been sorely underserved for a long time. And now with COVID in particular, locking families into, particularly toxic homes. I mean, children that can't get to school and can't find a mandated reporter. The sadness is the stresses of these families are greater. There's more substance abuse. There's more violence, and it's lasting longer. And really, there are not many signs that it's going to let up anytime soon. So as a society, the rest of us need to understand that these problems have been consuming us for a long time, and we've been underserving these communities for a long time. And that's why we've had to build so many prisons, and that's why schools have had such a struggle, because when you take the sheer numbers of the youth that have been damaged and the way we treat them with a punishment model that's been centuries old in this country, where we really do believe in punishment and the healing model that we know works through the ACEs, the work that's been done by the medical community, is having an uphill struggle trying to break into schools, trying to break into law enforcement. And that's where we're trying to concentrate now as an organization. Our first program really has to do with finding those mental health services that are offered by app-based and telemedicine that are sometimes 1/20th, 1/30th the cost of clinic-based mental health services, and they are effective. I will say that the youth, the younger people, are much more comfortable using them at this time because they like app-based things and would rather deal with, the easy way that they've come to know the integrated digital world. It's a little harder for adults, but just the availability of these things could change the mental health problems that have been facing people that haven't been able to get help for so long. So we're right now working to be able to offer those, and I'm ahead of myself now, but I am building the list. We're going to compile a list of 100 people that would like to have those services, and then we are offering to pay for them for 1 year. So actually, I do want that as kind of a centerpiece to our conversation tonight, so that if I'm going to post this on our website before Monday, and I am telling you that we're in a stage where we're negotiating to do this, so it's going to take me a little bit of time to make sure that we have the money as well as the service. But I do want to build a list of people that would be interested in that, and it will help us both with the raising of the money. And so that's a thing. I like to point out that it's available 24/7. There's coaching available through the app if it needs to be. So that's one thing that I think is going to make a big difference for the people that are suffering from childhood trauma. And it's hard. It's hard. People don't like to talk about it. It hurts me to know that there is a stigma that people feel that. I think that the new way of approaching mental health services, we can deal with that better. And secondly, the program that we are beginning to work with is training law officers in facing the fact that the punishment model in dealing with traumatized youth is the absolute wrong thing to do. We've got support from some pretty high-level people right now in the building of a program that will move into law enforcement. We're from Minnesota, and that's where we're going to start here. But the reason the jails are full is because we punish kids that have been punished in toxic homes. They have behavioral problems. We haven't done much for them in the past. We haven't done much good for them in the past, and the things that the police do, because that's how they're trained. And I do, I have empathy for the people that work in the field, so nothing I say here tonight should be construed as throwing rocks at the people doing the work. I just don't do that. My desire is to show people a better way of doing things, and I realize that in all fields, whether it be education, social work, foster care, or policing, there are people that make life difficult for everybody, and I hope that we can build ways of eliminating them from those programs. But right now,
right,
the 90%, the vast majority of people doing the work, mean well, and we do believe that between the de-escalation and healing models, we can bring into training and law enforcement classes, we can make a big difference. That's kind of the place to start with tonight.
Yeah, let me stop you there. I said let me stop you there. I just want to make a comment. What you said before, way back when, is you know, about community and community involvement and at least community education. Okay, the people out there just simply don't have, you know, the understanding. They see a child that is bad. They'll say bad. Okay, they'll use that, and you know, and they don't understand from where that child comes from. So I think that educating community and neighborhoods is, like you said, it's very, very important for community involvement and why you have certain things that are coming into action. It's easy enough to put a child, say, like in detention center. I have worked in detention. And the child doesn't get help, though. And like you said also, too, a child who is, you know, say, ends up in detention many times has been so horribly abused one way or another that when they get into detention, it's not anything that's going to be a positive for them. They're confined. They're in confinement. And that instills then the information in their brain that they've done something wrong, they're bad, and all this other stuff. What we need to do is to look into the family, okay? That's where the core issue is many times, is in the family structure. And so if your program is something, you know, that is going to be working also, too, with family, and I think you had mentioned that, rather than putting kids in foster care or unless it's totally necessary or, you know, in detention or whatever, that would be very, very helpful, you know, to the children. And the family structure then maybe could improve if it gets the proper help because, you know, a lot of times they need a lot of help. And then, too, if the family structure is too far gone, then, of course, then there is foster care. So what you're speaking about here are all things that I'm familiar with, and a lot of us are familiar with. And I love the very fact that you're trying very hard to work with the mental health issues, because there are so many people that have that mental health issues right there in the family structure, and that rubs off on the children, and it is generational, many times generational. So all these things that you're talking about so far is so true, and I'm so glad that you're here to discuss that with us, okay? I want to go to the panel, because we're building a panel here, and have them say hello, and maybe even ask a question so far as to what they've heard, okay? We have Lori from Calgary, Canada, our ambassador. Lori, say hi to Mike.
Hi, Mike. It's a real pleasure to be able to speak with you. I've been following your work for years, and I love what you're doing, and I would say just keep up the great work. I do have a question about the 100 people that possibly could access this telemental, like the mental app.
Yes.
Would that be just youth, or is that for adult survivors as well?
It's 13 and up, so it does appeal to NASCA folks. Yeah.
I was just wondering about that. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And
Yeah,
that's great. I love your work, and I think it's so important. I'm a survivor myself, and my brothers were. It's too bad they weren't around when all of this kind of help was coming out, because they ended up in we were all abused, and two of my brothers ended up doing prison time, and we're in and out of prisons for nonviolent crimes, but. They never got the help that they really needed, because they never really were able to escape that lifestyle, and because of their mental health, right? So I just appreciate the work you're doing. I think it's wonderful.
Well, thank you, and do check out our website, Lori. On Monday, I will make the site live, the piece I'm talking about, and I'll put in a contact piece. There will be it'll be a wait. It's going to take us a month or two to put things together, maybe three. Mm-hmm. But we are dedicated to making this happen.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
I'm really happy to hear this too. Yeah, this is great. You're right, Lori. Thank you so much for that. Let me go down to Bill from Florida, see if he has a comment he'd like to make. This is Bill, our founder. He's our CEO. Hello, Bill.
Yeah, hi, Carol, and hi, Mike. Thank you very much for coming on the show tonight. And I do want to get into a little more detail about the couple of programs that are new for you. But I also don't want anybody who's interested in the Kids at Risk Action basic, nonprofit work to shy away from calling in, because that's really vital. We've been featuring Mike Tikkanen and Kara for some time now, and I wanted to bring him back to talk about the work he does on a regular basis, but also to highlight these two extra programs, the app, which is means application for anybody that's too old to understand. That's for mental illness and working with law enforcement and students and so forth, explaining ACEs and childhood trauma. Both are really important. And, we herald invisible children and think it's, one of the best things we've come across. As Lori says, she's been following it for a long time. You're not new to this. You're a regular contributor to the NASCA experience, too. So I really appreciate you coming on tonight. We'll get into some of the details of other things as people come down the pike here and get interested in it. Thank you for being with us, Mike. God bless you.
Thank you, my friend. Nice to be here.
Okay. Thank you for that, Bill. Okay. Let's go down to Darlene in Tennessee. Hey, Darlene.
Hello,
how you doing? How you doing?
Hello. I'm sore, but I'm fair to Midland. I'm all right.
you're fair to Midland. My grandfather used to say that. That's I know where you're from. Oh, my goodness, yes.
Yeah,
okay.
I had lifted up some heavy, I had to take somebody to a doctor, two different appointments yesterday, so I had to lift up a battery, you know, an electric scooter type of thing. I had to pick it up myself, load it up onto the back, unload it and everything, didn't have a way up or nothing to load it onto that wreck, and I'm sore today.
Oh, boy. No, I bet you are. Oh, my God. You're busy working,
yeah,
though. That's good in helping people. Yeah. Do you have a question? Do you have a question for Mike, hon? Or a comment that you wanted to make about what he's doing?
I'm so glad I came to this thing tonight to listen, because I had never really heard about this before, Kara.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll be able to look into that more later on tonight or tomorrow. And I'll be able to keep it in mind, you know, when I run across some people as well as, you know, the NASCAR thing on top of the Kara. Because I've run across a lot of people who cannot afford to go on to get the help that they need. And sometimes there's just no help available for the mental health.
Right. Right, and it's so important that we have someone like this, you know, who has the foundation going, has ideas for the foundation, and, you know, that's it's very, very important. Otherwise, kids are just thrown into the system, you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
And we got to remember that a lot of the bullies or anything, for to say like that, they got esteem problems themselves, and that's why they bully others. If we could get into the programs to help these certain ones, it might help curb the bullying as well.
Mm-hmm.
That was my thought about, you know, that.
Right. It's our kids are in trouble. And I certainly didn't go into his bio, but he's going to go into his bio. But it's children don't understand, kids don't understand, if our schools don't change and all kinds of stuff, our kids are sort of like doomed. Okay, let me go down to William here, and I'm glad that he called in tonight. Can you hear me, William?
Yeah,
okay.
I'm here.
Okay, go ahead. Maybe you have a question or a comment. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I understand what they're saying about sometimes people don't know where to look for those resources and things, too, as well. They have no idea where they can find these resources and things. And that's why NASCA and others are so important, because they can kind of direct them and help them find the resources. And that's important.
Yes, it is. It absolutely is. Okay, well, thank you for that. And he's going to spend a whole bunch more. There's a lot of things here. And it's all for the benefit of you know, for saving, if you will, our children, because our children, look at what they're seeing today, William, okay? You know, and a lot of times it's generational, like we had mentioned before, and we know this. And what do you do with families like that? It's so hard to deal with something that's generational. I think that's the hardest. Bill says that, I don't know, he's not hearing the show. Okay, whatever. I hear it. You hear it. Does everybody else hear me? Lori, do you hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
I can hear you too.
Okay,
yep.
I don't know what happened there. Okay, I don't know. Well, I've got you guys, and that's important. Okay, so let's go. If you remember where you stopped off at, let's go from there, because I'm so interested in this, because I have worked with the kids and so forth. I still do, actually, and we always look for those that really care. Look for better ways of treatment, you know, for treatment. Just better solutions, looking for solutions. And that's a hard thing. Go ahead. You were talking about the mental health issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll start with saying that about a third of the kids in foster care in this country are forced onto Prozac-like medicine, psychotropic drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And those drugs have a message on the box about suicidal ideation, which few people understand. And really, I do understand it. It's fully formed thoughts of killing yourself, arriving in broad daylight without any chance of removing them or dealing with them. They just drop like a dream, a live, awake dream. And I've worked with children as young as 7, 8, and 9 on 2, 3 of those drugs at one time. It makes me crazy to know that that's what mental health services have been, and I think in many places still are. We've reported on that. By the way, we do reporting. That's what Invisible Children really does on its website. There are 1,500 pages. Some of them are pages that go into depth about these sorts of thing. The Mercury, San Jose Mercury News, did a video TV show, three-part series, on the thing I'm talking about. That's on our website. And it just, in working with children as a volunteer, CASA Guardian Ad Litem, getting to know the families, getting to know the stresses, getting to know how the kids are being helped or not helped, I've got just so many stories. I actually have a book I wrote about those cases that's free on the website. It's a professionally read audio book you can listen to, invisiblechildren.org, under About Care and our book. And you can just listen to it while you're working or doing something else. But it tells a story of what it was like for me to work with children in child protection. And really now that I don't take cases anymore and simply cover those issues kind of as a journalist and reporter, I can tell you that in 2014, America put 20,000 1- and 2-year-old children onto Prozac-like drugs. That same year, they sued Johnson & Johnson for billions of dollars, and they paid a civil fine, and it should have been a criminal fine, but the language of the lawsuit read that they had illegally sold those drugs to pediatricians for use on very young children. Now, I have so much familiarity with those drugs that it's hard for me not to sound outrageous. But it is around the country. It's been the cheapest way to control the outrageous behaviors that traumatized children have. On the one hand, teachers and police and people that deal with these kids are having a very difficult time because the danger the child poses to him or herself and to others. I say about teachers that in most elementary school and junior high schools that have really troubled kids in them, the teachers are spending 80% of their time taking care of 1 or 2 children that could hurt themselves or hurt others. So there are, you know, I get into the economics of it, and there are many different reasons for why we as a community would be so much better off by spending the money to make sure these kids get the help when they need it. But instead, we as a nation have this punishment model, and I'd like to draw everybody's attention to the concept of the punishment model that America is founded on. We expel 3 to 4 times more kids from daycare centers than any other industrialized nation in the world. We expel many times more children from elementary schools, from junior high schools, from high schools. And it's because we don't have the means to help them. We don't have the crisis nurseries. We've never really had the mental health facilities. It's always been 900 to 1,000 students per counselor in the schools. It should be 50. I don't know what the number should be, but it shouldn't be 1,000. And they should be better trained. The problems are greater than the average person can manage, and that bakes into foster care and adoptive care. It bakes into why the police are failing and why, you know, they have high divorce rates. They have high secondary trauma rates. They have alcohol. You know, it's baking into all parts of our society. And our hope, of course, as an organization, Kids at Risk Action, is that we can be the bullhorn shouting from the rooftops about what works. We have an organization or two in Minnesota that have been 80, 90, almost 100% successful in dealing with whole families that have suffered from trauma, that are suffering from trauma. It's just that the scale up to provide the help is just almost impossible. Well, it is, with the resources that we don't allocate. We don't have near enough subsidized daycare, quality daycare, crisis nurseries. It's really hard now during COVID for so many families suffering from so much more stress, losing jobs, you know, and it's just us. There's nobody else. It's us. We got to talk about it. We got to talk about, that's part of what we're doing with the police program, is making an argument to law enforcement that they need to help us advocate for the things children need. Because at the end of the day, they end up dealing with really troubled youth, and it shouldn't be their problem. Police are not trained in the ways of mental health. They're trained in law enforcement dealing with crime. And until we can help communities understand the difference of a 12-year-old that's out of control and hitting people, being tasered, and I've got stories about how jaded, you know, jaded police become. I mean, jaded people become, and they are only going to use the tools they've been trained to use if that's all they got. And the 12, and I use the word 12-year-old, but I mean, we're incarcerating in this nation, it's a quarter to a half a million kids a year are faced with being tried as adults. And now with, and I don't, now they're going to reverse, I'm pretty sure, the laws at the Supreme Court level where we quit incarcerating lifetime, juveniles for lifetime. And we just quit about 4 years ago, and we're going to bring it back. And that kills me. That's just killing me. And actually, we just 8 years ago removed the execution of juveniles for federal crimes and crimes that were committed as juveniles. So we're looking, you know, down the barrel of the punishment model that this country was founded on, you know, the hang 'em high, the three strikes you're out. And it's just one of those things that people get behind because they don't know any better. And I have stories. I have stories that are very positive about politicians and people of authority, policymakers, that didn't get it. And then one day they did get it. And their whole life changed. And they went from not caring and not supporting crisis nurseries and not supporting good quality daycare and not supporting mental health services to supporting those things. In my state, I suppose it's been 8 years now, I had that happen. And my story really has to do with the sheriff's department in my state threatened to sue the state and the counties for not providing timely mental health services to the people in their squad cars and jails. Mm-hmm. And I took that third of a page article out of the Minneapolis Star and Tribune into a politician's office and talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I got her to understand that she didn't want to be on the wrong side of that argument. And I ended it by saying, you know, if they can sue you, why can't we? You know, in the Child Protection Services area. And it wasn't just that shook her up. It was she was on the wrong side of that argument. And there's a lot of people on the wrong side of that argument. This ain't rocket science. The cost of what's happening in this country because of child abuse, childhood trauma, and the fact that it never goes away without some help from someone somewhere, and we the people, you know, we are the people to make that happen. It's a lot less expensive to help these kids because 30, 40 years of recidivism, and now in this country we are facing 90% recidivism at 9 years in the prisons. I mean,
what's it
going to take? Yeah. So I go on. So if there's a question or a redirection, let me know in what I'm doing.
Well, what I want to point out here is that if they don't get the help that they need, even while incarcerated in like, say, in detention, or if their detention is actually, you know, it's supposed to be for no more than a month, But many times they extend it way further than that, and they're not getting the help that they need. And then all of a sudden that you take them before the judge, because that's what we do, and you take them before the judge, and then the judge decides, well, they could go into foster care. Well, why is there such a turnover in foster care? A lot of times there's problems with the foster parents. Yes, they're not properly trained. That's true. But also, too, because the child is so dysfunctional himself and never got the help that he needed. So that child then ends up back, say, in detention center. So it's like a circle. And then, of course, as they get older, then they go into prison, you know, if they don't receive what they need for help, you know, as a juvenile, as a child. So it's really a very sad situation. So if we can have someone to enlighten and to bring forth new laws and to bring forth education, you know, to the justice system, going all the way back to our children who are so, you know, they commit heinous crimes, just like the, because you had mentioned that they commit the same crimes as those that, you know, who are adults, okay? If we can help these children, the proper help, then with mental health, you know, and anything that they might need. And if they are on medication, if they are the right dosage level, which should be checked very frequently, like on a monthly basis, to make sure. And you can see that in the behavior as to how the child is, you know, either getting better or not getting better. But keeping an eye on all of those things, maybe in time that child will become the person that he or she, you know, could have become if they have the right type of treatment. I agree with that. 100%.
My experience is that if you are able to intercede early, what's optimistic in me is that children know normal when they see it. So dysfunctional families are what they are. Yeah, preteen moms, teen moms with no parenting skills, a drug habit, a violent boyfriend. Common, you know, it's got to be the way it was. There can't be different. But the children, if they find normal, in my experience, they want it. They see it. I've seen children parent their parents, 6, 7, 10 years old. They know what they want. And if everything falls into place, and if there's a community behind them, and that's what I mentioned about the Washburn Center for Children's Mental Health, that had 80-90% success rate fixing families and broken children. So we do know what to do. We have programs that work. Unfortunately, the public will to make sure that they're everywhere all the time is just not anywhere near where it needs to be. And so the idea of the rest of us recognizing and advocating and talking about this, I'm going to make a point of this. One of our board members made public policy in Europe for 10 years on children's issues when he was stationed there for a big international company. And he was a liaison manager, and they told him to get involved in the community, and that's what he did. When he came back here, he became a CASA guardian at Lightham Like Me, and that's where I met him. And he was so appalled by how America treated other people's children compared to how the rest of the industrialized world. And I could get into the data, but people hate it when I do that. But just technically, they have 10% of the crime, the violent crime, the prison population, that we just don't shine. And when they need to have taxes over in Finland or Norway or Sweden or all over that Northern Europe, they buy newspapers, the New York Times, and they spread them around and they show them to people about what's happening in America. And those taxes are cheap to those people when they look at that, because we really do suffer statistically. Again, I fear getting into the data with people because they hate to hear it, but do know that we really don't hold a candle. Our safety nets are nothing like they have been in the rest of the industrialized world. Largely that's because after the Second World War, it's a bit of a history lesson, but it's worth knowing. After the Second World War, those nations recognized that they not only had to rebuild their buildings, they had to rebuild their families. They knew they didn't have a functioning society, they wouldn't have the buildings would stand empty. There wouldn't be much use for them. So they made sure that young families got help. They made sure that mental health facilities, young families with babies, I mean, and everybody's suffering now with COVID, and everybody's suffering now due to the financial distress of so many young families and jobs. But they had what they needed to build healthy societies that don't have giant prison populations. And the violence we're suffering in different areas has a lot to do with the immigration and the things that are outlandish and hard to manage. But their core populations are just healthier than ours are. One of the last lectures I had on this particular topic was Dr. Bruce Perry, and it was about 10 or 12 years ago. And he made the point that within the next 10 years, 25% of Americans are going to be special needs people. And that really is probably more than true today. 66% of the kids in juvenile justice have diagnosable mental illness, roughly. Half of that population have chronic, severe, and multiple diagnoses. 80% of kids aging out of foster care lead dysfunctional lives. And we should care. It's painful. It's a public safety, a public health issue. It is a pandemic. It is. It's its own public health crisis. And the Surgeon General.
What you're saying there. Let me just say something to reiterate what you just said, because it's so important. Because people don't have this understanding, Mike. Okay, the public, they don't understand. Okay. They don't understand the behaviors of the kids, and they just look at them, you know, as being, well, they just look at them as being no good. And that reinforces how they already feel. You said something a while back, which is very interesting, because I can identify with that. I knew what normal was. I'm a people watcher. I was a family watcher. Many of us are like that, those of us who have been abused. We didn't have people to nurture us. To show us right from wrong. We didn't know boundaries. No one taught us boundaries. But I remember sitting and looking at, you know, like a family structure sitting in front of them, you know, outside in the open, and watching people loving their children and teaching their children and playing with their children, and the happiness that exude from them. You'd see the happiness. And I would think to myself, my God, I wish I had that. And you see, a lot of the kids that are out on the streets, okay, the ones that get into trouble and then do end up in juvenile detention, they come from the backgrounds such as that, which so many of us right here on NASCA have done also. Now, I think it's like something that you mentioned much earlier on, too, that the core issue, which I give it the word of core issue, which it is the issue, if you can go into that family structure. This doesn't happen overnight. This isn't something that can be fixed overnight. But if you work with the families instead of just throwing the kids in juvenile detention, okay, and maybe not getting the mental health that they need, which they so very, very much need, you then we're going to continue to have kids acting out on the street like we even know of today. Okay. So go ahead.
You know, the... acquisition of the skills it takes to live in a complex society don't come from the stork. And when I said, and I feel sad when I say teen and preteen moms without parenting skills. It hurts me to say that. But these young women want love in their life. They've had miserable lives. And they know a baby's going to be love, and they're going to love the baby. But they need help. They need help raising a child. Coping skills don't come from the stork. And in a normal family, mom and dad sing to the baby, read to the baby, bring the baby into family, and then there's a daycare, and then there's the elementary school, and then there's all those things that we can get as family members with healthy families. But these other babies, the babies that are born into the families that I've been removing from toxic homes for so long, they don't read well themselves. My first 7-year-old in the caseload had 6 or 7 words in her vocabulary. Mm-hmm. She was so frightened of me. I was frightened of her. I just have these stories of children that have been terrified, traumatized, and tortured. And yet their skill level of being in that child, by the way, where I should make an opposite point here, is that what I've also learned is that these children that grow up in these really grotesque circumstances often have a level of street smarts that surprise. I mean, I read the suicide note of a 7-year-old boy in Florida. That was a boy that left a note about Prozac. And I thought it was written by a 40-year-old person. I did. And there's a case, I'm forgetting his name right now, but it's 10 years old or 8 years old, the case. But these children have, and in so many cases, they're absolutely brilliant in certain ways. One of the boys that I worked with who had been, again, 7 years old, he'd been tied to a bed, sexually abused, beaten, and starved for 4 years. He won second place in a dance contest at a giant high school. I mean, he had such talent. And I look at if we can help these kids, and I should take a sidebar and just talk a little bit about the arts, about how hard it is for these children to find something that can get their mind off the thing that the amygdala, the reptilian part of their brain, is owning them so much, you know. But whether it's poetry or dance or writing or singing, it doesn't matter. If we can help them direct their talents and their time and their skills into a place that can allow them to lose the baggage that just, it takes a long time and a lot of help to get rid of that stuff. And there are ways, and I'm not trying to tell people how to do it right now, but there are so many programs that do work, and if we can talk to people about how better to treat these children and to kind of remake the point about coping skills and how do kids get them, that's really what we're talking about, is helping kids gain the skills they need to live here. And believe me, there's so many avenues a human being can go down to have a lovely life. It hurts me to see how constrained we are as a people by who we are as a people, as Americans. You know, we have got so many, restrictions in our lives about who we can be and what we should be and do. But really, to have a happy life is to have a happy life. And if you can get guidance to have a happy life, well, that's all that matters, in my mind, anyway.
Well, you see, you brought out another point, too, is that these kids so often, they don't even know that they have something special about them. You know, it's like it hasn't come to surface yet, because in the families that they're living in, they're always told that they're no good. They're you know, you're stupid. You're whatever the derogatory things can be said to a child. And that's what their minds are like sponges. These are the people that are supposed to support them and nurture them, and this is how they feel about them. And what society doesn't realize, you know, I don't have to tell you this, Mike, is that these same children, they're going to go out and they, sooner or later, might very well, you know, commit crimes, or they might, be suicidal. And suicidal ideations is something that I suffered from at one point in my life. And there's a lot of people who are survivors who have suffered from suicidal ideations. And it's not fun. No, it's not. And, we turn into these children and we try to grow ourselves up. And we try to function a little bit in society, and we don't know how, okay? We don't know how because we haven't had the guidance, the proper guidance that we needed. We don't have the skills. So many kids do turn to alcohol and drugs, which we brought up, about 25 minutes ago. Yes, we do turn to alcohol, many of us, and drugs, and to other things. You know, it can be any type of thing that becomes an addiction, whether it be overeating, you know, anorexia, or the other, you know, and it doesn't matter. The point is the child is so terribly dysfunctional, and then they're going to cause a lot of dysfunction in the school system and out on the streets, in their neighborhoods, and everything else, because I believe, too, that it's lack of proper training and understanding in the mental health field to the police departments and to other organizations that deal with children. They don't get it, you know, in the school system. This is something that has to be, we do have special ed classes, we have that, but are they trained well enough?
The saddest to me about our school systems is that the politics that exist, and children really are a political football. The superintendents that make the rules are like the rest. They're powerful people, and they're like the rest of us until they know. And I will retell the story about the politician, because I think that's where you and I and everybody in this radio talk can benefit, by knowing that we might know somebody that knows a superintendent. And where this starts is letting people know that the story I'm going to tell you has to do with a principal that was thrown out of his school because he was using the ACEs healing model instead of a punishment model. I was called in by his coach. He was a 50-year-old man with 4 or 5 children, and he loved his job. And he knew how to handle out-of-control kids. And so he told his 60 elementary school teachers that if they had a severe problem, to bring that boy or child, girl, to him. And that went on so long, and there was 4 teachers out of the 60 that were adamant about more punishment. And my this principal that I'm talking about was on a Prozac drug. He was visibly under stress, duress. He was just shaken, and he knew he was going to be fired. And I worked with him. He called me in on a holiday, and the 60 teachers listened to me talk about the ACEs model and why you don't punish traumatized children and how authority figures look to traumatized children. It actually really is true with police officers, because they're hated automatically by most traumatized children. They've been tortured by their primary authority figure, and they really hate cops. And so they're not much on teachers either. So the idea that these 60 teachers, almost all of them gave me a thumbs up. It was a 4 or 5 hour session, but the 4 teachers that hated and wanted punishment ended up getting the guy thrown out of the school. And I helped him find a lawyer and sue the county and come up with a pretty good settlement. But he lost, the kids lost, the teachers lost, the school lost, the county lost. It stinks. The superintendent didn't get it. There was just no winning the battle. And those 4 politically powerful people got that man fired. I feel, you know, that happens. And if you Google North St. Paul elementary school principal suicide, you'll find another man in my city, not the one I just talked about, who killed himself. I talk about the level of stress that teachers and principals and people that are working with my kids live with, and the politics surrounding it. So for the rest of us to be able to talk to your teachers and let them know you appreciate and ask them the question, are you dealing with kids that throw the desk out the window or that hit kids and beat them up and bully? How can I help you? You know, and it really is calling the superintendent. It is. You can call the principal, but the principal answers the superintendent. Now, whether we write letters to the editor, whether we call our state representative, but all of us need to do a little bit more. It's a personal thing. It's a democracy, and people have been, unfortunately, in the political atmosphere we live in right now, we're just about afraid to stick our heads up. But if we don't lobby for children, it ain't going to happen.
Right. And in the meantime, and I'm going to go to the panel then. In the meantime, you know, society sees the behavior of children who have been so abused and who are so dysfunctional, and they don't know from where it comes, okay? So they just judge the child, you know? And the child doesn't get the help that they need, even if they are incarcerated, you know, in detention or in a mental health facility for the emotionally disturbed, like Devereaux. The Devereaux Foundation was famous when I was working years ago, and at that foundation, actually. That was working with emotionally disturbed. Yes, they were given far too many meds. Yes, they had to have their blood levels checked all the time and all kinds of stuff. And some of them made it out of there, Mike. They did. And they did work with the families, and they were able to go back home. But for the majority of them, it wasn't that way. And in these places that you're speaking about, you do have to watch for people who, you know, tend to want to commit suicide and who do suffer from suicidal ideations. It's a very rough thing that you're dealing with. Let me go to the panel. I want to bring Lori back on from Calgary, from Canada. Lori, your mic is open. Do you have any questions or comments you'd like to make?
Well, no, I'm just listening, but I'm just so relating to everything that Mike's brought up. And I mean, I grew up abused, so I was a child in school having problems with difficulties, and teachers, we were red flagged because there was a CPS was involved. But my behaviors, definitely, I in the 60s, it was still corporal punishment in the schools, and I remember being punished in the school and then going home and being punished, and I was just like, nobody really cared. Nowadays there's a whole lot more information, but what you said there really hit me, and it has hit me for a long time, because I've been advocating now since I started my healing journey, so that's since 2009. But if we don't stand up and we don't lobby for the children, who's going to do it? So what you said there, Mike, was just like so true. It's all of our responsibility. And, I don't have children, but that doesn't matter. I grew up in abuse, so I know all about this stuff. It's horrific. And so we got to get people need to care, They really do. I'm listening to what you're saying, and I'm like, well, I so care. I really do. And I think everything you're saying is just so true. And it is very... it's heartbreaking, and the issues are, if you're right, if we don't do this, who's going to? As a population,
jump in a little bit and talk about how important it is to talk about. See, the media, when we wrote the book in 2005, the media wouldn't publish chapters, wouldn't publish any of it. The most progressive magazine in the country is the Utney Reader. Eric Utney told me that if I published those things in my magazine, I would lose my readership. I believe that's largely true today in the newspapers. There's a lot of reasons the newspapers aren't, or they never have. It never sold newspapers. And so people don't know. They don't know for a reason. It doesn't sell newspapers. And so if the rest of us don't talk about it, and there's a second reason I should mention, and that is that, and I'm in the Institution of Child Protection, and I've heard the lecture on how we don't talk about it for two reasons in the institution. One is that if you took it home with you and talked about it all the time, you would have more secondary trauma, and then you'd quit earlier. You don't last in a job. So you got to be able to leave it at the office, which is a sad truth, but I don't think it's a good enough reason. The second reason that is not spoken, whether it's policing, education, or social work, or foster care, is that everybody's going to look bad, which is, believe me, not a reason to not talk about it. We all do look bad. Let's talk about that. We could look better if we had better answers. But because it is such a tragic topic, and people do not want to hear about it, and by the way, this is the distinction between us and the rest of the industrialized world. When you watch their public service announcements, they scare you. They hurt you. They want that.
That's right.
They want you to wake the hell up to what's going on. Now, when we do public service announcements, they're kind of Mickey Mouse. We just got done with a run of them ourselves, which are on our website. And I love the man that did them. He's a nationally known journalist, and he did a nice job, and they're as good as they can be by American standards. But they need to be like the Europeans. And for the rest of us on this show tonight talking about it, realize that people don't like to talk about it, and they're not going to bring it up. But it needs to be talked about. And for me, I've become somewhat of a nut about it because I am so frustrated. I've watched this for so long. It has been so depressing to see these kids go through this, and really I don't have happy stories. It hurts me to say that. But I'm going to do my part. I feel I'm committed to it, and the organization we work with is passionate, and we're not asking for permission to talk about it. We're just talking about it. And if more of us did that and occasionally called us, our state rep, who has to listen to us, he may not or she may not like what we're going to tell them, but they're going to hear it. And in the end, we've been winning those battles, but it's a slow slog. And we have to be able to show people that we're paying attention, and have some data, have some either a story. We've got a family here in Minneapolis that impregnated one of the two daughters twice. They lived like rats in the cellar. There was 100 social worker calls and 50 police calls to that home, and nothing happened until the oldest child escaped. And believe me, they were tortured beyond words. It's in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It was called, I can't remember all the names now, House of Horrors. It made it in the paper.
Yeah.
But unless that sort of thing happens, it does make paper, unless they die. It just saddens me. These kids deserve to be known. That's why we write about them. That's why we talk about them. And eventually the politicians will get the drift. And by the way, as a sidebar, the economic argument is even more powerful to the people we're talking to than the ethical or moral or what's the right thing to do argument. The economic argument, if you read on our, on our website, there's the Age of Mass Incarceration visual you'll see there. We give the cost of crime in America, and most violent and serious crime in America is committed by youth, by juveniles. And it's between $500 billion and $1 trillion a year, based on two recent studies by Iowa University and Washington University, St. Louis. And that does not include if it's your child or spouse or friend that gets beat up, robbed, or raped. That doesn't include that cost. And I'm sorry if I chuckle once in a while, but it's the absurdity of the things that I talk about just always hit me in the head, that we do the wrong thing, and it's very expensive, very painful, and yet we continue to do that. So hopefully, if more of us talk about it and realize that it's going to take a while, stick to it. And actually, one more sidebar. If you go to our website and go to Take Action, at the bottom it says sign up for our Friday updates. If you do that, every week you'll get a note from us about some new and important thing that we could do, could talk about, could bring a change to. So I ask everybody listening to do that. Go to invisiblechildren.org. Don't go to .com. If you go to .com, you'll end up in Uganda. And sign up under Take Action, and you'll get our Friday morning updates.
Okay, well, you got that out. That's very good. Thank you for that, Lori, too. You have here the need for civic involvement. See, I'm very much into community, Mike. This is what I somewhat often work with. I work with the homeless. I work with kids out in the street. I do other things. But the need for civic involvement of young future community leaders, young community leaders, is a solution to America's at-risk youth problem. Now, when you go into the universities, when you do that, a lot of times you have to have permission as to what the topic is going to be. And things that I have found out with a lot of the professors is they don't allow for certain things to be mentioned or brought up, okay? Sometimes it's very hard working through the professors, and I don't understand that because, again, if we want to live in a better society, and if we want to reach the children so that they can get the help that we need, we have to have the college kids are going to become social workers, a lot of them, or they're going to be, maybe they're going to become police officers, or they're going to become this, or they're going to become that. And if they don't have the proper training, and it's something that's looked down upon, like it's not that important, like child abuse is not that important, and what happens when a child is abused is not that important, you know what I'm saying? Then it causes an awful lot of problems. So there's a problem right there, too, right in the school system, right in the universities. I want to go down to Darlene and see if she has a question or a comment to make.
Hello?
Darlene? Yeah, are you there? Can you hear me?
Hold on a second,
Darlene?
I swallowed. Yeah,
oh.
I'm here.
Okay.
I'm
Do you
sorry,
have a question
I
on this point? That's okay, honey. Do you have a question?
There's a comment I wanted to make. Let Bill William can validate this, that I have a friend that he doesn't believe about the PTSD. He thinks I'm overreacting about Whenever I hear a loud noise, almost like a gunshot or something just very noisy, I just let out a scream. And my friend tells me I'm overreacting, that he doesn't believe that I'm really suffering for that. He thinks I'm really just looking for attention. And it's kind of aggravating to me, especially because it draws attention to me in public. The last I don't want to do is, you know, bring attention to myself. Well, anyway, my friend had even joked around with me when I said, well, I thought, you know, this was such and such, like, for instance, you know what I'm saying? I thought, and he goes, that's what you get for thinking. But now, every time I say something, I go, well, I shouldn't have thought, I'm stupid for thinking, you know, all because... even though my friend was joking, it's got the repercussions of bringing that negativity back to me. You see what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not
so
nice about that sort of thing. I don't know how to be nice about that. That's not, I don't know. You might not want to talk to me about that. I find that really offensive, as somebody that would belittle.
Yeah.
A mental health issue. That's just awful.
Yeah, when I'm going ahead and saying if it's the PTSD that's doing a lot of this, and then whenever I just say anything, you said you have these fits often? Anything, you know? And now I'm like second guessing myself and looking around like, what's the wrong with me? You know, I've been a nervous wreck. And so I'm having to redo some things all over again. And try to get myself back out of that depression, which I'm digging myself into because of me second guessing myself and calling myself stupid again, you know, going back in that hurdle.
Well, I wish you well.
So,
I'd look for a new friend.
Yeah.
Well,
I wouldn't
yeah.
consider that person a friend. Okay. Well, they don't have the understanding though, Mike. See, that's the problem with society. They don't understand
yeah,
about PTSD.
Yeah, still, I'm careful who I put around me and as I get older. And it's just hard. It's like I tell people, don't plant your seeds on concrete.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
life's too short.
Yeah.
But that's me.
I just think if this friend knew more about PTSD and about mm-hmm. the effects that this has on someone,
Does he read?
He doesn't read nothing about child abuse or nothing like that. He just
reads
about Christianity.
Again, yeah, I'm sorry to say, but if you're dealing with somebody that really doesn't care enough to know, that's not a friend.
No.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for that, honey. And I hope you take Mike's advice and mine also. Because a friend wouldn't do that to a friend. Okay, think
no.
about it. Okay.
Right.
Let's go down to...
Because they always said, I'm just joking. It's like a joke, and you get so tired of hearing that, you know?
Well, then forget about it. Okay, here we go. Forget about it. Look, forget about that person. He's not your friend. He's not... Well, he's not educated in PTSD, nor does he seem to care to be. All right, he'd rather like point a finger or make you feel bad about it yourself, and you're already triggered. Okay, so you don't need to have someone like that in your life. You really don't. I can't tell you what to do, honey, but I can tell you this: that all of us here on NASCA understand what you're going through, and you know, you stay away from toxic people. And that's
right.
what we have to learn to do, okay? Let me go down to William here and see what he has to say about all of this. Go ahead, William.
Yeah, you're right. You want to stay away from toxic people. And there's a lot of people that don't quite understand people that have PTSD and stuff. See, I deal with it because I was around people that were in robberies and things like that, and different things like that involved in the law end of things, and they develop it when you're facing guns in the face and everything else. So there's a big difference in some of that. And a lot of these people aren't even aware of what this stuff is. They don't understand it. They have no concept of it. And then the stigma that goes with mental health issues, too. There's a stigma that goes, well, what's wrong with you and things? And oh, you just this or that. That's not good because people really do break. And I mean, anybody that's been around counseling or anything like that or, see, I'm a little different because I came from the Vietnam era, and I've seen a lot of this stuff from some of my buddies and things that were sent over there that came back. So I've seen a lot of the stuff from stuff like this. I know what Jeanette, Darlene and that talking about and stuff, because I know Darlene, too. Everybody knows that, but most everybody knows that.
Mm-hmm.
That I know Darlene.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and there's some issues that she had that, because the guy up there is the guy that sometimes covers for me when I can't help her, when she needs help and stuff and needs to get this or that done. So sometimes there's an issue with that too, but hopefully I'm working on something. They're actually my brother-in-law and sister are working on something for her. So hopefully she'll have a set of wheels underneath of her for in a little bit.
But, well, I think she's very lucky to have you, you know, that she can speak to you. You two are close. And, you know, so she's actually one of the lucky ones because there's so many people out there, people who are listening now know this, and then those of us who are survivors, of course, know this all too well, that a lot of times there is no one, you know, who understands fully how we feel and the things that we go through. We know what we went through. We know how it felt. We know how it affected our lives. And it doesn't have to be something that, you know, that makes us our lives to be this way forever. We can get help, okay? There is help out there. And I do want to mention really quick, Mike, about our website, too, because we do have programs available for people. Darlene has a good friend, and he's very knowledgeable. But there's a lot of people who don't have that, okay? So on the front page of our website, you will see programs, and I do mention this just about every night that I host, is you'll see red lines, red blocks, as I like to put it. And the very first one is programs, okay? That's on the left-hand side of the website. And if you click on to that, you'll see the world turning around. And, excuse me, because we are, you know, it's not just the United States. We cover, you know, all over the place, different countries. But you will go to, like, the United States, go to Nebraska, click on to that, and programs will fall down, okay? You'll have programs. And you'll find help in your area so that you're not alone. Okay, go ahead and continue, Mike. I've got a tickle in my throat. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know, I actually should
Can I make a comment or two here, Mike?
I'm sorry?
She skipped me. Can I make a comment or two?
Sure, go ahead.
I want to go back to all the way back to where you mentioned about how the European experience is very different than ours and tell you that I totally understand what you're saying, but, you know, because they came out of, say, a Second World War where the entire continent was destroyed, it was relatively easy for them to see that they had limited options, but one of the things they needed to do was make sure their families, you know, survived. Beyond the buildings, they needed the families to survive. We don't have that. What we have right now is, unfortunately, a pandemic where we're awfully self-obsessed about it, each one of us individually, and with good reason, is worried about our own public safety. And really the only thing that we can do about it, for it seems, until something better comes along, is to, you know, wear the masks and physically separate and isolate and all that. But children can't deal with that. Now, these children who are trapped in homes, especially because of the COVID stuff, who aren't going to schools, they're trapped in situations where the traumatic life is all they know. That's what goes on in their home, and they can't escape it. They are not, you know, when you, children normally don't find care workers. Care workers find them, or at least community people find them, and then usher them into the mental health or the child care industry, if you want to call it that. But, you know, because we've cut so far back on all these things, we're not ready just to provide what's really needed, especially when there's an uptick in the number of cases there are. Now, it's equally important to understand that, like you said, the cost of not dealing with child abuse, dealing with the way we do, which is not dealing with it. We used to use this, the $548 billion, which is $500 billion. That figure was 10 years ago when the CDC did a study. And I haven't found better statistics, but I want the point I'm bringing this up for is I believe what you said is true. The financial aspect of this, in other words, we would save so much if we would change our direction on how to deal with child abuse than what we're doing now. The financial consideration is probably the biggest thing that'll grab somebody's attention, not the other stuff, not the morality of it, or not the health care of the children, but the savings of the country, let's put it that way. And the last comment I want to make is lots of people in these industries, including, for example, law enforcement, for example, social services, for example, health care and mental health industries, they're burned out. They don't go home and talk about it. In fact, so many of them have so many clients, they can barely keep them apart and straight. We have to put some money where into increasing these resources and training people a lot better. And we have to stop giving that job to law enforcement. It's not their job, unless there's a union going on and, you know, so forth. But I just wanted to make a couple of comments because she skipped me on the last round, and I really value what you're telling us, and I believe in it, too. As an aside, I've noticed recently, and I don't know how I missed it, Los Angeles, where I come from, has recently posted 26% increases in homicide. That's outrageous.
Wow.
And it's what used to be going on when I first got involved with community policing in the 90s. And we were able to reduce that number down and down and down and down. And then we were going 20% less every year for a long time. Now it's going back up, and that's shocking to me. It makes me even think about, like, coming out of retirement and going back into it at least for a few years to see if I can help them turn that corner, because we're sacrificing ourselves at an unbelievable rate, and it's really all about talking, like you said, Mike. And Carol, and everybody, the community is what makes the difference. But you got to reach them.
Right.
In order to reach them, you got to go out there and talk to them, and you got to explain these things, and you got to listen to all sides and so forth. So, I don't know. That was an aside, but it was shocking to me to read that statistic the other day. I was not prepared to find that out. But thank you for being here tonight, Mike. We really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, my friend.
Well, community. It's so important. Go ahead, Mike. You were about to say something.
I would like to point out that California has done something that might be positive, and that is they've appointed a surgeon general. Her name is Nadine Burke Harris. She's a pediatrician, and she's written a book called The Deepest Well. And what it does is it encapsulates everything that we've been talking about at a community level and the healing model. She has declared ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences, to be a public health crisis, a public schools crisis in her state. And I am hopeful 7 other states, I believe, have jumped on board to declare ACEs, the healing model, their state's new approach. Now, The truth is they haven't really done much to make it happen, but they're talking about it. And I guess that's back to what Bill said. I mean, we're talking about it. So supporting the Nadine Burke-Harris California public health crisis and talking about this, both really whatever it is, you know, I don't think it matters so much what part of the animal you have, you know, just start talking about it, because each one of us brings a little different perspective. But whether you're talking about foster care or Prozac or crisis nurseries or taking care of young mothers, you know, the outcome is fiscal. It's public health, public safety, public schools. The last thing I think I want to really kind of double down on is that we really do need to support the frontline workers. The people doing the work don't know if they're on foot or on horseback. They have been piled on. I mean, when a child dies in child protection, it's always a social worker's fault. When the governors right. run for office in my state and other states, they blame the teachers for failed schools. And so, you know, and so on. I feel really bad about people that get into these fields because they want to be a teacher. I've had teachers cry in my presence when I was writing my book, and they told me what it was like. And really, I've watched the pain my kids cost those teachers, the things they do to them, and police. I've got police stories like that, too. So we have to support the people doing the work. We have to approach it as adults, recognizing that there are no silver bullets, and it's up to us to do the things that have got to be done. And a little bit every day is probably all we got.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
But we got to do that, right, Carol? Everybody's got to do
Absolutely.
That a little bit every day. Yeah. Thank you, Ken.
Well,
Michael.
You know, let me say something. With the COVID out there, there are so many people, like myself, like Bill, that do like to go out and work with the public. We do like that. We do like to do our presentations, and we do like to educate as much as we know. We educate. We've been educated, and we put it out to the people so that they'll become educated. But the COVID has, you know, put a wet blanket on a lot of different things. And what Bill was saying before, and I'm going to have someone on soon that's going to address that issue, but the children who are at home, where all of that terrible, terrible abuse, you know, is happening. That's what really, you know, is one of the big things that need to be addressed too, because, you know, where do they go? What can they say? Who do they? They can't tell another family member because that family member will go and maybe beat up the person that, you know, who assaulted them. And but that's not a solution. You know, I mean, it's a very hard, difficult thing. So these apps that you're speaking about are very important, and other things that are coming out are very important because the need is there. People are understanding that the need is there finally, and there might possibly be some solutions that will happen, take place, to help children. This doesn't happen again. It doesn't happen overnight, but it's a start. It's a beginning, okay? It's a beginning. And something is better than nothing, because many of us on NASCA have been in that situation where the abuse started at home first, the sexual abuse, and then it continued on after that, inside, outside of the home. It doesn't matter. The point is it's there, and we had no one to turn to, you know. So as long as we really put ourselves out there as much as we can to educate, you know, society, first of all, I think it was Lori that had said, sorry, you know, and it's so true, society has to care. Well, the only way to get to society's brain and get into their minds, I get annoyed at times, forgive me, but, you know, they have to have their house broken into because maybe yeah. the drug addicts, you know, then, oh, gee, they're on drugs, and then they look into the history of where that child came from and why they're breaking into houses. Oh, so that's why that happened. Okay. You know, what if you people in society have got to stop turning and looking the other way, because it's going to affect them sooner or later. Their houses are going to be broken into. or maybe the cars are going to be stolen, or maybe someone's going to get, raped or whatever, okay? Because the person who's raping them didn't get the help that they needed either. They don't have to be pedophiles, okay? This is sex offenders. So, you know, there's just so many ways that it does actually, affect society. And also, too, don't forget that in paychecks, a certain amount, it's a small amount because it's each everybody, but it's, paycheck, a certain amount does come out. Who do you think pays for, the organizations for the kids, like Juvie or even like DevRose and all the other ones that are out there? Who work with children, house children, inpatient children. It has to come from somewhere. It comes out of our paychecks too, just a little bit, but it's there because the problem exists. So what we, right here, right on the show, and the ones who are listening, who know that this problem exists because maybe they too are a part of that. I was a juvenile delinquent. I just didn't get caught. Okay. So, the point is, kids like us, we end up doing things that we can look back upon because now, of course, I'm on my healing journey. I'm way into my healing journey. And I can look back and say, hey, that was wrong on my part. I didn't have to do that. But if you don't get the help that you need, okay, then many times you never reach that point. You might end up in prison. Why is the prison population, they have done surveys on and studies on the prison population and how many of them were abused. What type of homes did they come from?
Yeah, I point out to people that what happens in the home is what's normal to a human being. That's just what normal is. How would you know any different unless you got help from someone else?
That's right. That's right.
I am going to ask
a lot of time. Go ahead.
Just to make the point that if there is a coordination with NASCA for the 100 people that we're looking for, I want to reiterate on that I'll put that out on the website. Maybe send it to Bill and do make it known if you could to your internet audience, the people on your website, that we are doing that because this is a natural fit for the program that we have.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's something you and Bill can speak about.
Anything. Please do. We'll be happy to help you out. And, I also want to thank Mike for coming on tonight because we needed a slot filled for a special guest, and he had these couple new programs. It was perfect for us. But we're having the same problem for next week, and just give me 30 seconds here to say, we need guests all the time. There's a new tool on the front page of the website that identifies Lori Smith as the person to contact, but we list the 5 next open dates, and guess what? Monday, Wednesday, and Friday are the next 3. In other words, we don't have special guests for Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I don't know what we can do to fix this. But we've got a new tool, and Lori is going to help me coordinate that effort. And so I put it out there. Mike came through for us this week, but it would be nice if we didn't have an emergency all the time, Carol. So thanks for giving me that 30 seconds there.
Okay, well, that's good. I'm glad you put that out there. We shall work all together. I already have 2 guests that are coming on, but they're a little bit down the line. It's not someone I can just pull out, right this second. But, we have things, roadblocks in our ways right now, but that doesn't help NASCAR. But we'll find someone, Bill. I'm sure of that.
Okay.
Okay, so anyway, the point is this show is over, and I want to thank you so much, Mike, for coming on. And as usual, you gave a very, very good show and a lot of education, a lot of knowledge, and a lot of possible solutions. And this is so important. So I can be one of those kids that you work with, only I'm grown up, I think. And I'll say thank
Believe
you to
me,
you.
It's a lot cheaper to help kids now than to incarcerate them later.
That's Absolutely. Right, you bet. That was my point before, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's right. So everyone, you know, we will be back on Monday, and we will have shows. We will be here, and you know, I know we're living in a crazy world right now, but this too shall pass, one way or another. So I want to thank you for listening. I know a lot of people listened out there tonight. Thank you so much, and good night, and God bless.
Thank you, friends.
God bless.
Welcome.
Good night, everybody.
Good night. Gone, you are forgotten after all that you've done. Blog Talk Radio.